Now, on to our conversation. We are here with our guest, E.R. Shipp, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, journalist in residence, and associate professor of journalism here at Morgan State University, Tyrone Keyes, author, public affairs strategist, and public relations expert, whose work can be found at realityneversleeps.com, and George Zornick, reporter for the nation's Washington, D.C. Bureau. George, Tyrone, Shipp, good to have you all here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
And join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We want to hear from you as we explore the NSA and the Affordable Health Care Act in the rest of this hour. People are already written in on our Facebook pages. We'll get to those comments. They've written in about the NSA. Or you can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Again, 410-319-8888. Let us begin with the NSA, the National Security Agency. Now is revealed that they've spied on the Chancellor of Germany, Merkel, began in 2001 in the presidency of George Bush, continued through the presidency of Barack Obama. Fox News accused Obama of knowing about it, but that's been denied by the NSA. Though you have other people writing, like Congressman Grayson from Florida, who has security clearance, saying nobody knows what goes on the NSA. Nobody is telling us the truth. I'll read some of those quotes. They've spied on millions of people in France. There's been more and more. So the question, we'll begin there, but then I want to kind of also look at the power of surveillance and what we know about, don't know about intelligence and the private industry of intelligence in America and the public industry and the power of surveillance companies. People have just now revealed that looking at the campaign election records, contribution records, that the surveillance industry is a huge contributor to campaigns in America. Huge, and we'll get to that in a little bit as well. So what does this say to us, Shipp?
Wow. it's surprising that we're finding all of this out right now, but when you think about it, it's not so shocking that our government is doing this. It kind of makes me think of Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy. You know, when you're a child, it's easier to think of those things as real and to think of our government maybe as being good. But as you grow a little older and learn a little bit more, you realize you have to put Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy in a special category. And I think we have to start thinking of the government that way too, particularly after 9/11. It's become fashionable for everybody to pry into our lives in the name of making us more secure, ultimately, by ferreting out threats from enemies at home and any enemies abroad. And I think perhaps because we've been lulled into thinking that they're taking care of us, we've forgotten about how pernicious this surveillance is and how wide the net is being cast. So now we're hearing about presidents of countries that are our allies are having their cell phone conversations monitored. And I think that's beginning to raise some hackles.
George?
Yeah, I agree. It is surprising that we're hearing about it now, but it's one of those things where you have to wonder or assume that at some point this was going to come out. I mean, you had a surveillance state, and it's been a huge problem that's been growing exponentially since September 11th behind the scenes. But as it's grown by leaps and leaps and bounds, the public discussion of it has been basically non-existent. If anything, the public conversation about it has gotten quieter as the security state has gotten bigger. So at some point, there was going to be an Edward Snowden. There was going to be someone, given the size of how many people work for these agencies, how many contractors they employ, how many political appointees know about it, how many people on the Hill know about it, that at some point it was going to come out. It was inevitable. And for it to grow, for that to be that kind of mismatch between what the public knows about and what is going on behind closed doors is cannot last forever. And obviously, and luckily it didn't. But the question now is just it's so hard to know still about what's going on. All we really have to go on are these documents that Snowden released. And you get into all these questions. The question of the week now in D.C. is, did Obama know that the NSA was spying on Merkel's cell phone? They claim he did not. You know, that's a real reporting challenge, because you can look at it and say, well, obviously he must have. He's, for something that politically sensitive, there's no way they wouldn't have notified it up the chain that we're spying on world leaders and friendly world leaders' communication. But from a reporting point of view, how do you prove that? I mean, you know, we deal in facts, and how do you know? You don't. There's absolutely no way to know. And that's a problem with much of what's going on, much of the surveillance state stuff, is there's no way to know. It's all kind of happening in a locked box.
Tyrone.
I would actually agree with both of the previous points, but I would go on to say that I am not sure whether the president knew or not. I think what's going on today with this vast and, you know, growing in power, this bureaucracy, is that they receive very broad 30,000-foot mandates, and then they interpret those as they see fit. And it results in things that specifics that the executive branch may not be aware of. And I think this may be one of those instances. And I think that if this is the case, it's very disturbing, very troubling, because what you have developing is you have power being taken away from the executive branch of the government. We've seen power taken away from the legislative branch and being funneled into the bureaucracy, which no one votes for the bureaucracy. They're nameless, faceless, and I think that represents a real threat to what we know as our republic here in America.
Well, to your point, I mean, even Snowden was relatively low on the totem pole when you think about who has access to information. And he had access to quite a bit that members of Congress are saying they didn't have access to. So I think you're right that the power is somewhere dispersed out there among this bureaucracy, and people are acting on their own agendas. In some cases, they may think they're acting on behalf of the Obama administration and in its interests, when indeed they are probably not, from a political perspective, but they are really trouncing upon our American values here.
Absolutely.
So we had a lot of emails coming in, and actually some, not emails, but Facebook comments. You can also join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Thais Barrera, I hope I said your first name right, wrote in that Dilma Rousseff was the first one to reach. She postponed the state visit scheduled in October until more explanations about the phone bug were given, because she is the president of Brazil, who was also spied upon, and Brazilians were spied upon. So the question is, if it's in fact true what you were saying earlier, George, that you know that we don't know. One of the questions is whether President Barack Obama knew or not. I don't know if we know that President George Bush knew or not. We don't know who knew and who didn't know sitting in the White House. But that's the problem itself, isn't it? I mean, if we're seeing this exponential growth in power of intelligence agencies and of surveillance in America, I mean, this is a fairly kind of frightening advance of what's going on, what happened to tens of millions of French citizens, Brazilians, Germans, and now the Germans did not complain when they found out from the Snowden reports that Germans had been spied upon, but when it became to the chancellor herself, then it came up.
And now the Spanish are.
And now the Spanish are getting into it as well because of what was being revealed. And tomorrow, just throw a little added twist in here, tomorrow on our show called Soundbites, which is a look at the American our food system and the future of food in America, there are now companies that are giving supermarket shelves for their products that have cameras in them to detect your race, age, body type, and more, so they can find out more about who to sell to. So when you go to the grocery store now, you're going to be seeing, you won't even know they're there. They're inside of the shelving put in by the people.
So when I go to get that Snickers bar that I know I don't need anyway,
they're going
to
know you got it.
I'm
going to...
Yeah.
So, but the kind of corporate spying as well that goes on, the surveillance cameras that are in cities for our protection, allegedly. All these kind of raise issues, George, that I think are much broader than just NSA, but the NSA should lead us to a deeper discussion. We're having a difficult time getting there to have it.
Yeah, I think one of the most under-discussed things in this whole scandal is the angle of commercial espionage, of the U.S. and the NSA gathering data that is not purely just for national security or even diplomatic advantage, which I think would be wrong, such as it is, but the kind of commercial espionage that Glenn Greenwald has alluded to and that others have spoken of, where, you know, when you're spying on these world leaders' cell phones and communications, not just to learn a diplomatic secret, but that they're finalizing a contract with such and such oil company, or, you know, that they're not going to oppose this tariff or whatever it is to advance not only the national security, but the economic interests of the country. So that gets into something, I think, even scarier, where you have the surveillance state kind of doing the bidding of, if not directly, but of corporate interest in the United States. And so where does that line bleed to? And obviously it's something that, as you mentioned, that the corporate interests themselves are quite good at doing. I mean, you know, I remember even 5 years ago it was surprising to see an ad come up on your computer, on your Gmail, or on your Facebook that was targeted just to you, and you'd think, wow, that's kind of creepy. And now that's not, I mean, compared to this grocery store thing, that's nothing.
Yeah, it's enveloping all around. Before I go back to Tyrone and Ship, let me go to phones here. The folks are calling in at 410-319-8888. Marcus, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome.
Why are we surprised that these things are going on? I mean, are we forgetting that back in the Nixon administration we started recording politically here in the United States? So it seems to be normal. Are what we doing, is it the long run issue? Is what we're doing in surveillance benefiting us in the long run? I mean, in general, that's what we do, even in our everyday lives. We make decisions today. Will it benefit me tomorrow? And this is what the government does on a daily basis, I believe, is if you make a budget for today that's going to prospective make the country better 20 years from now, why wouldn't you already be monitoring people to see whether or not things are going to be better in the future for our relationship? It seems to be general. And I think as a person of color, I personally think we've been monitored in the beginning. I mean, what's a Social Security card for? Except to monitor you, where you go, what you do, how much you make, what you spend. That's what your credit card, the chip on the back is for. So it's a police world. I mean, the cameras on the phone, the cameras on the telephone poles. Are our liberties at jeopardy, or is this just the normal way of the future?
I think, Marcus, you raise a really important point. And Tyrone Keyes, one of the things that struck me about what you were saying, Marcus, is that we have come to accept this stuff in our daily life. So when we see these NSA revelations, we see some people who are libertarians or people in the left opposition in America who will stand up and march in the street and go, what are we doing here? But for the bulk of Americans right now, it seems this is what this is what we expect, and we don't stand up to it. And it's pretty frightening when you think about the growth of this.
Right, and I think this gentleman has a great point, because what we're also seeing, he's right. You know, if you look back at J. Edgar Hoover's card catalog, he had files on Americans. But with the proliferation of surveillance technology, you know, they're like kids in candy stores right now. And they have the capability to literally spy on everyone and break down every minute detail of an individual's life. So I do agree that this has been going on for decades. However, centuries even. I think that, you know, spycraft is something that has been going on since the advent of government. However, we've never seen it to this level because technology has facilitated, you know, what we see today. But I will maintain that there is a danger in the electorate becoming comfortable with this, because at this level, again, it is a danger to the republic that we have.
Now, is that a universal feeling around this table, George, and then to go to Ship?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, to the caller's point, even if you believe that the surveillance powers are appropriate and necessary and are keeping us safe and so on, you always have to, I mean, you look back in history when the FBI began monitoring Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders because they felt they were dangerous. You know, even if you think that Obama is the perfect president and is using these powers very wisely right now, the point is that he's entrenching them, and that at some point there's going to be someone taking over and in control of these powers that may have a very different idea of who is dangerous and who is subversive. So to put these tools in place without any kind of public check, I think is a very dangerous thing.
Right. I think that's true. I was surprised, and maybe I shouldn't have been, but I was surprised last week when I learned that here at Morgan State University, there are over 600 surveillance cameras all around, ostensibly to protect us. But the director of public safety here was speaking to students and talking about an incident where a student said he had been robbed. And the public safety department here was able to go to its various cameras and look at footage and track where that student had been at the various times he said he had been there on campus and just outside campus, and figured out that his story didn't add up. So that was an interesting story in itself. But the more interesting story was they have these cameras. They can do that. They're watching us. Now, I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but I was surprised and upset that, you know, anything I'm doing is on someone's camera. It's the same in the apartment development where I live. They have cameras saying you could be in a public space. You know, the cameras are watching you all the time. So we are getting used to it, but I'm troubled that we're getting used to it, and I don't want to be accepting of that.
We got to take a quick break. We'll come right back to that, and sure, also to what Steve Ballinger wrote on our Facebook page. Join us at 410-319-8888 as we continue looking at NSA spying in America, what it means for our lives. And I want to know why all of you aren't as outraged as our guests are, at least where you think. And our guests are running from left to conservative on this panel. What are your thoughts? 410-319-8888. And we'll talk a bit about Affordable Health Care Act as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
And curtains laced with diamonds dear for you. And all the Roman noblemen for you. And kingdoms, Christian soldiers dear for you. Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked her way across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way. Shaved her legs and then he was a she. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild
side. Take a walk on the wild side. Lou Reed passed away over the weekend. So we're celebrating his music and what he brought to the world of rock and roll, as well as having our conversations here. Lou Reed, we were joking during the break. He said once said, I was born Jewish, but my religion is rock and roll. So he added a lot. It was because of him so many bands formed, and he put his politics and sexual feelings out there in very early time. So career was a bit uneven, I always thought, in terms of his music, but one of the great poets of our time and an influential figure. And remind you on the way to our conversation that support for WEA, which is where you hear the Mark Steiner Show, is provided by KIDA. And my guests here this hour are E.R. Shipp, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist journalist in residence and associate professor of journalism here at Morgan State University, George Zornick, reporter for The Nation magazine's D.C. Bureau, Tyrone Keyes, author, public affairs strategist, and public relations expert, whose work can be found at realityneversleeps.com. And y'all at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. And I will read this Facebook thing in a minute. William, with the next caller up, we're going to come right to your call. But, oh, William just disappeared. Well, come back. 410-319-8888. And with our phone system or you, but whatever it is, we want to hear why you are outraged or not outraged by this and what you might also think of the Affordable Health Care Act. 410-319-8888. Tyrone, you're on the air. I mean, Tyrone, what were you about to say before we went to break?
I was going to add to what Professor Shipp said. The surveillance outside of areas where you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So if I'm walking up Park Heights, I don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So there is, you know, a case to be made for surveillance in public places. But when we get into the home, when we get into places where we do have that reasonable expectation of privacy, and we're starting to see an encroachment into those spaces, people laugh at me all the time because with my tablet and with my computers, I put a piece of tape over the camera. And I do that because, I don't know if you all remember, but there was a school district, the Marion School District in Pennsylvania, who they came under fire for giving out computers to students and then using those computers to spy on the kids at home and in school. So I think that, you know, we're in the pot of water that's coming up on a gradual boil. And we don't necessarily, we've got to be really careful about delineating the places where we should have privacy and the places where we cannot expect it, and drawing a clear line as to what surveillance takes place on either side of that line.
Let's go to the phones at 410-319-8888. William, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well. Welcome.
I was calling about the issue with the camera. No, I don't have a problem with it. And the reason why is because the thing is this. If you're not doing anything wrong, then you don't have nothing to worry about. It's no more than when you ride past and you may see cameras outside of a mall. The cameras outside of a mall is not to invade the privacy of the customers. The cameras are there to protect all of the... I mean, it's one of the reasons, but it's there to protect all the valuable products that's inside the mall. So if you're not doing anything wrong, you should have nothing to worry about. Like, for instance, I told the person that took my call that at the intersection, for example, certain people are now so gung-ho about hopping in other people's cars, like if it was friends following each other and someone was to forgot they'd get in an accident, somebody can hop in another car and lie and say they were there in the car and this person caused an accident. Well, with the cameras being at the intersection, they can go back and play and see who actually caused the accident, as well as who ran away. You know, so if you're not doing anything wrong, you shouldn't have anything to worry about. Cameras are definitely there for everyone's protection, regardless of color. I don't feel bothered at all, and I'm 32 years old.
George, how would you respond to what William was just saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth definitely having a conversation about. I think there are a lot of good arguments for having, say, security cameras in a mall or street cameras. I know there's been crimes solved in my area because someone was picked up crossing the street on a camera, and that's, you know, I think it's a good debate to have. And I think, you know, not all surveillance is per se bad. They have a cool sort of thing here in D.C. where it's an audio monitoring system over the city, and when there's a gunshot, it recognizes the sound and can triangulate it and pinpoint it to a particular corner so that the police can go there, because a lot of times when people call and say, oh, I heard a gunshot, well, that could be, you know, it's very hard to narrow down. So that sounds kind of creepy, but I think is ultimately for the public good. And I think it's something worth discussing, though I think circling back to the NSA, the point is that a lot of this stuff isn't being, not only is it not being discussed, we don't even know. We know what Snowden told us and nothing else. I mean, he's, as someone said, a relatively low-level guy, so what else are they doing that we don't know about? This stuff was clearly never debated. People in Congress didn't know it. You know, with the cameras on the street, I think there are plenty of good arguments. Some people have valid bad ones, but you can elect people to the city council who say, I'm for these cameras or I'm against them, and, you know, you can hash out the policy, and I think at the top level, that's not happening.
I agree with that part, but I still just don't like being watched. And I understand that there are some arguments for public safety if we're talking about police surveillance of streets and malls and such. But since we don't know who's doing the monitoring, we see all the time various abuses, and I don't like it. So I would at least say, yes, let's have some debate, some reasoned debate.
And if you go back to, I think the caller needs to also realize that, you know, when you talk about, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, then you're okay. But who interprets what is and what is not wrong? If you look back into the mid-60s when the FBI spied on Martin Luther King Jr., okay, they actually, when they felt as though he had connections with the Communist Party, the FBI wrote a letter to Martin Luther King Jr. implying and suggesting that he kill himself. So who is to interpret what is, you know, what is wrong? At that point in history, there were a lot of people that thought that the stances that Dr. King would take, was taking were incorrect and incongruent to the country. So, you know, we need to be very careful and not just take that broad approach of, oh, well, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, then you're okay.
I mean, Congressman Alan Grayson wrote a piece for The Guardian, and the title of the piece is "A Congressional Oversight of the NSA is a Joke. I should know I'm in Congress. I have learned far more about government spying on citizens from the media than I have from official intelligence briefings." Then he quotes the 1970s Congressman Otis Pike of New York, who chaired a special congressional committee to investigate abuses by the American so-called quote-unquote intelligence communities, he wrote. And Pike said, "It took this investigation to convince me that I've always been told lies, to make me realize that I was tired of being told lies. I'm tired of spies telling lies, too." So I think that the problem is that there's a power here that we don't, that if we don't address, could come back to haunt us and haunt our republic, haunt our sense of democracy. I think that's part of the, you know, that for all the good it does, without oversight and control, it could become a tool to really oppress people in this country when things get tighter. I mean, I think that's part of that's my biggest fear in all of this. And I don't think the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, especially post 9/11, are being clear with Congress. Every congressman I talk to, congressional representative I've talked to, then when they go to these meetings, they can't take notes, they can't question, they can only listen. And I think there's a danger in all that.
I think so too. And even with the Obama officials saying that they are reviewing their practices, particularly regarding surveillance of foreign officials, they're saying that they want to make sure they're only collecting information they need and not collecting information just because they can. But what determines need, and whose need, and for what purpose is it needed? That's part of this discussion that I think you're saying we need, and that Congress needs to demand if they really are to have true oversight.
Steve Ballinger wrote in on our Facebook page, Stephen writes in, "You know, Putin was blasted in America for calling out the United States for its pervasive attitude of boastful exceptionalism. It seems to me that the problem begins there. The reaction in America was just as expected as the defensive backlash you get when you call out a person who is full of himself. America/Americans are so convinced that everything here in America, our way of life and our agenda for the future of the world is so superior and exceptional to the rest of the world that we are treating the rest of the world with self-righteous disrespect. Even our closest friends and allies. This, I believe, is just part of the issue. Also, it seems to me that a country that feels the need to spy on its own family and closest trusted friends has issues not befitting to a constitutional democracy. And those are the issues that need to be addressed."
Well said.
So writes in Steve Ballinger on our Facebook page. And you can write in here as well and also talk to us at 410-319-8888. You know, and that leads me to some of the other big issues, the other big issue of the week. Let me just say this. There's a piece in realnews.com over the weekend that we'll be linking to on our website. Jazil Noor, who is one of their producers, interviewed Tom Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. And he was talking about the numbers, the huge number of surveillance companies, the amount of money they pour into Republican and Democratic campaigns, that have a lot to do with, some people would argue, influencing legislation that has to do with allowing these things to take place. I mean, that's, again, this confluence of kind of corporate power, intelligence services, Congress afraid to stand up. This is where the danger lies for us, I think. I don't know, that's my own editorial comment.
Well, that's always been the case. The military-industrialist complex and all of those things going back in time. So it's not surprising that corporate America, in this case, the surveillance part of corporate America, will be contributing to campaigns. What might be surprising is why candidates are accepting the money when they pretend to be our protectors of our civil liberties.
And I think once they've done, you know, once they do that, I think that they've abdicated their role as protectors of our civil liberties.
And they need to be called out.
Absolutely.
We have one listener who writes in, Halima writes in, saying that the NSA takes its privileges. I don't willingly submit. All right. So 410-319-8888. Let me switch gears on y'all for a moment and talk a little about the Affordable Health Care Act and what our analysis is of what this thing really means for America. And I know some people are kind of loath to attack it because they don't want to fall into the right-wing attack against legislation. On the other hand, I think a lot of the critics right and left of this legislation have a lot to say about it. I don't think it's this socialist masterpiece that some of the right would say. I wish it was. It's not, but on some levels. But it is. But what when we look at this in terms of the what it says about the power of insurance companies and the cost of insurance and what will be paid for. I just read, I think it was in the New York Times this morning, that you know, for a family of four who make over $28,000, which is 138% of the poverty line, they don't qualify. So they'd be forced to go on to Medicaid, and that means that hundreds of thousands of people, especially in states run by Republican governors, will not get the insurance because they're not taking the Medicaid money and they're also not participating in this service. So what do we think about what this act really is going to mean? And also the last thing I'll throw in here about this is that as someone else commentary was made the other day, said that it was on another talk show on WAMU as I was driving across state listening to it, said that just like the Medicare-Medicaid Act of the 60s, it took 30 years for every state to comply because it's a slow-moving process. So what do you think?
Well, some states just got around to eradicating the 15th Amendment this year, didn't they? Mississippi or something?
Right.
So it does take a while for some states to catch up. But I think we've not gotten into a serious discussion of what this law will mean because we're distracted by the incredible incompetence displayed in rolling out the program in the first place. This whole glitch in the computer system, and now the president has put together a hotshot team to try to rectify that. But so many people have been turned off and frustrated because of the difficulties in signing up that we're not spending as much time trying to figure out what does it mean when indeed they can sign up, if they can sign up. I don't think anybody really quite knows how many people will be able to qualify as the system currently exists, and whether they can afford the plans that they might be able to qualify for. It seems like a lot of people are going to face great increases in their premiums. So I'm not quite sure in the long run whether we're going to be helping the 24 million uninsured. I think that's the number
right
that this plan was supposed to address.
George?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you're a progressive, it's very frustrating to see these terrible website troubles because you spend all this time and energy trying to convince the public that the government can deliver services efficiently and that it's better than the private sector because it doesn't take advantage of you and it's more democratic and so on and so forth. So to convince people that government is good and then have the major initiative of the past 4 or 5 years kind of fail right out of the gates is very frustrating for a lot of progressives down here. I think they will get it fixed at some point, but it's not the way they wanted to see it start off. I do think, you know, on the premiums, it's true that they're going up, but there are some modifiers here because if you are up to 4 times of the poverty line, then you also qualify for a subsidy under the law. And part of the reason that the premium price is going up is because on the individual market, the Affordable Care Act says, well, you can't exclude people with pre-existing conditions. You can't offer these bare-bones plans that basically, you know, charge you money and offer you nothing. They beef up what has to be offered. And so obviously if you're beefing up the plans, price goes up. So the sticker price goes up, but when the subsidies kick in at anything up to four times the poverty line, then the overall price may end up being lower for a lot of people. In some states it is, some it isn't. Basically, it comes down to whether if you're young and healthy, you're going to see your premiums go up, because before you could get kind of a bare-bones plan. If you are not as healthy and you are having trouble finding it, not only will you find insurance, but it'll probably be cheaper than what you were paying before. So I think it's kind of a mixed bag on that front.
Tyrone.
Well, we've seen, in addition to the botched rollout, we've seen the other part of the compensation piece, the deductibles. Some of these deductibles are so incredibly expensive that people have questioned, well, why do I have insurance? If I have a $13,000 deductible, there's no reason for me to pay $50 a month, because I'm going to be responsible for everything up to $13,000. And most people, unless you have some sort of serious illness, will never reach that in a year. The other thing is, and putting aside, my feelings as to the legislation, I think what needs to happen, and you find a lot of Democrats kind of starting to suggest this, is you need to take a step back and just go back in and revamp the website, remarket the whole thing, and roll it out again. And I don't understand why there's a reluctance to do that, because the White House could spin it as, listen, we want to get this right. This is the law, and we want to make sure it works for you. So we're going to, pause it for, 6 to 8 months, get it right, and then we're going to roll it back out, and it's going to be better than ever. So I'm not sure why, they're repairing the airplane as it's flying, so to speak, instead of landing it, repairing it, and then taking off again.
But to do that would be, I think, from the Obama administration perspective, would be caving in to those naysayers who want to defeat the idea from the start. So you're now hung up in politics and strategy. About half of the state governments are not planning to participate. Those are Republican states. And I think the Obama administration doesn't want to give them more ammunition. So to say that they're going to pause it for 6 months, 8 months, a year, whatever, I think that will never happen.
Well, I do agree. I definitely agree with you. I would just like to see them, and again, putting my personal feelings aside, I just think that they're running the risk of alienating so many people that would have otherwise been enthusiastic about it with all of this negative press, that they're really up against a rock and a hard place.
So, because one of the things I was reading just today was that I think the highest out-of-pocket cost, and I could be wrong about this, but when I've been reading about the Affordable Health Care Act, is $6,500. But having said that, that's a lot of money for a lot of people to put out. If you're making $3,000 a year, even as a single person, that's a lot of money to put on the table over a course of a year. When you think about it, taxes taken out of your pay, then you've got to come up with an extra $6,500 a month. I think that there was a march in Baltimore Saturday. We'll be playing a clip from that. Our former producer, Christina Arison, went and taped it, and we're going to play that story tomorrow here on the show. But there were hundreds of people from across the state of Maryland who came in to the march from the Creative Alliance to Care First as a symbolic act for a single-payer system, for Medicare for All. I just wonder how many of us think that there were maybe 60 congressional representatives who were supported that when this debate took place in the beginning, and that debate was shelved. Nobody allowed it to happen in Congress. But the more complex this thing gets, the more money it costs people out of pocket, the more they see the limitations if they only have bronze or platinum and not gold or whatever those things are that people have. This could become part of the discussion again.
Yeah, I think George? One of the most underrated sort of parts of the law was the Medicaid expansion that went from 100% of the poverty line up to 130, I believe it was. And in the original bill, remember, every state had to participate. You had no choice. It was, you can thank John Roberts for gutting that part of the law and then giving the Republican governors the option to get out of it. I do think over the long term, the next 10, 20 years, all the states will end up getting in because it's such a good deal. You get 90% covered even after 10 years. But in any case, you know, that was an expansion of government-provided, what is essentially single-payer insurance to millions more people. And that was something that kind of, I think, I mean, obviously it's been much discussed, but not in those terms. And I would like to see Democrats go on the offensive with that in the future, expand Medicaid further up, get on the offensive. Like you hear Republicans always talking about maybe we should raise the Medicare eligibility age. Well, you know, why not a push to lower it? Why not a push to kind of expand Medicaid upwards and Medicare downwards and see what happens? Because it is frankly the most efficient way to deliver it in terms of overhead costs. The infrastructure is there. I mean, no one's having trouble getting their Medicaid or their Medicare benefits. So I do think it's something that you'll see percolate up in the months and years ahead, especially if the system gets too complex.
But it'll have to wait until after the next election cycle, because no one's going to come out with any bold suggestions or initiatives until they're convinced that they're safe in their seats.
What I'd like to see, really, it'd be interesting to see as the Democrats get ready for the 2016 presidential race, who, when they start talking about health care, who comes out and says, I'm running on a platform that includes adding the public option to the exchanges, which is something that very narrowly made it into the didn't make it into the legislation last time. I think it was Joe Lieberman finally cut it out in the Senate, but it did pass the House. So, which, you know, is Hillary Clinton or is Martin O'Malley someone else going to come and say, my health care plan is to introduce a public option to the exchanges?
Well, I think that's all dependent on how this initial implementation plays out in the next couple of years. Because it's almost at the point where healthcare may be in danger of becoming a third rail, where, you know, people want to talk around the edges of it. And if it doesn't roll out smoothly, if these problems are not fixed, then we may be looking at 2020 before a discussion like that takes place. So we'll see.
I mean, I think that what this plan does not do, and none of the conversations taking place, whether it's the Tea Party opposition or what's happening in the Affordable Health Care Act or health care costs, that is what's dragging America down. That and some security costs are really dragging America down financially. The cost of health care in America is just absurd. I mean, the cost of pharmaceuticals, cost of hospital stays, the cost of insurance premiums. We have a small company here the Center for Emerging Media that has a few employees. We produce a show. We do other documentary work. We work at different universities, and we have a small little dynamic group. But our health care and premiums are skyrocketing through the roof this year. There's no control over these health care premium costs at all for small companies and for people trying to survive and what you have to pay for, what you can pay for, and deductibles that are like at $2,500, $3,000 a year. And for people making $30,000, $50,000, $60,000, or $70,000 a year, as a family, that's a lot of money.
So does that make you want to switch to the Republican point of view?
No.
On this?
I have been clear about in my writings and other places that a single-payer Medicare system in America is the only one that makes sense. But you have to include controlling the costs of health care in that, or it doesn't make any difference.
But how do you do that? You could, one of the ways, and this was something that was not discussed in depth with the Obamacare debate, was, okay, how do we actually do that? One way is tort reform. If a surgeon leaves his Rolex inside my abdomen, then, yeah, I'm a pretty bright guy, I'd like to believe, but am I going to make $10 million, you know, for the remainder of my life, or $500 million? So something has to be done to control the cost of the malpractice insurance and the lawsuits, and then you will see a resulting decrease in what pharmaceuticals and what doctors charge. They're passing on a lot of that to patients.
I think that's true, that about malpractice costs are just outrageously high in America. But I think it's the smallest part of the argument of where healthcare costs come from in America. But it is part of the issue. But the biggest part of the issue is controlling insurance companies, hospitals, and pharmaceuticals. And on that note, I'm going to thank our three guests. It's been a really good discussion. E.R. Shipp here from Morgan State University, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Tyrone Keyes, political activist in this community here, George Zornick, reporter for the Nation magazine's DC Bureau. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks.
We're going to take a break. We're going out. Today's birthday is Ben Harper's birthday, one of my favorite blues musicians. We're going out with my own two hands. Stay with us. We'll be right back as we pick up looking at city school construction.
I can change the world with my own two hands. Make a better place with my own two hands. Make a kinder place. Oh, with my own two hands. With my own two hands.